first of six block lectures by David Chalmers. This lecture is entitled The Scrutable World. I first heard about David when I was having dinner with the great David Lewis in the early 90s. At that point, no one, or hardly anyone, had heard of him. And David told me that there's this guy coming out of Indiana University who was going to make a huge splash on the philosophical scene. And sure enough, he did. He's widely regarded as not only the most eminent philosopher of mind of his generation, but perhaps the most eminent philosopher of mind simplicitaire active today. And he's also done groundbreaking work in the foundations of semantics, in the epistemology of the a priori, and in the metaphysics of modality. He didn't begin in philosophy. He started off as an undergraduate in mathematics at the University of Adelaide and then came here to Oxford to continue his studies in mathematics in, 1987? Though an increasing interest in foundational issues forced his intellectual attention to philosophy, and as a result, he went to work with Douglas Hofstadter at Indiana on a range of topics in philosophy and cognitive science and received a PhD from there. He then went on to a postdoc at Washington University at St. Louis. His first job was at UC Santa Cruz in California. He then went to the University of Arizona, where he also set up a very successful Center for Consciousness Studies that proved to be a stimulating forum for an interdisciplinary exploration of foundational questions concerning consciousness. He then moved to Australian National University, where, as well as being a professor of philosophy, he's a director of consciousness studies there. And recently, he's in addition accepted a visiting position at New York University, which he'll, for the foreseeable future, be combining with his post in Australia. The breakthrough work for David, without question, was his 1996 book, The Conscious Mind in Search of a Fundamental Theory. Not everyone liked that book. Some responses were very negative. I quote John Searle's review, the New York Review of Books, where he wrote, "It's one thing to bite the occasional bullet here, but this book consumes an entire arsenal." In a way, the negative reactions weren't too surprising, and they were by no means uniform, of course. For one thing, David was young. He was barely out of graduate school and writing a book that had the amazing combination of popular appeal. He tells me it sold 60,000 copies, which is really quite amazing. And at the same time was on the cutting edge of professional philosophy, was the thing that everyone was talking about, so to speak. Very rare combination, that. Bound to attract some negative reactions, especially among someone so young. Turns out that I've discovered that just by growing old, people get an increased view of you. When you're young, it's not surprising to get better views, but like those that John Searle gave us. The other thing that made it not surprising was the sheer audacity of the book. There was a trend in orthodox philosophy of mind towards exploring the minutiae of functionalist accounts of intentionality and consciousness. David's book was a full-blooded defense of an anti-materialist philosophy of mind that to many seemed like something of a throwback, and combine this with an attempt to make the world safe for a kind of rationalism that seemed to have its place in the 17th century, but many would have thought it no longer had a place in contemporary Anglo-American philosophy. So there's something very audacious about this book. Not surprising that it had its detractors, but that book had its virtues that have ensured that it's going to stand the test of time. Unlike so much philosophy, it really made an intense effort to combine carefulness and clarity. And unlike a lot of philosophy, it really is rewarding to work through that book and figure out what you think's wrong with it, if you think there's anything wrong with it. Since that book, David's written an awful lot. He's attempted to cash in on the philosophical agenda set out by that book, writing numerous papers exploring further issues in the foundations of semantics, and particularly two-dimensional semantics, in the metaphysics of modality, and in particular the relationship of the epistemological category of a priori to modality, and in the metaphysics of consciousness itself. Though his work's by no means been limited to that range of topics, he's written at a rough count about 70 papers, and the philosophical breadth is quite amazing. He's written on Occam's Inner Language, on perception and the fall from Eden, on the two envelope paradox, on the metaphysics of the matrix, on the unity of consciousness, and the list goes on. First and foremost, I suppose, David is a system builder who pays great attention to foundational questions. The system relates the issues in the metaphysics of mind, and in particular of consciousness, to topics in metaphysics, and in particular the scrutability of the metaphysical structure of the world, and issues in epistemology, especially the nature of rationality and the a priori. His talks in the next few weeks will expose us to a wide range of those issues and really give us some insight into the character and depth of his thought on these issues. Every Thursday at 10:45 there'll be an opportunity for discussion with David. There'll be a two-hour session every Thursday. I strongly urge especially graduate students to attend those discussions. I presume that you all want to hone your philosophical skills, and I presume that you all enjoy exploring philosophical ideas. I can think of no better way to do both those things than in the company of someone so stimulating and engaging as David. Well, I don't want to take up any more time. I'd like you to welcome him and make sure that his stay at Oxford is philosophically rewarding and personally enjoyable. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John, for that really kind introduction. And thanks very much to all of you for coming today. It's a privilege to be giving these lectures, and it's a pleasure to be back at Oxford in the company of so many old friends. As John said, I was a student here maybe 23 years ago. Turn this on. I started a DPhil in mathematics, went on to become a mathematics dropout, dropped out of mathematics to do philosophy, eventually moved overseas. My friends in mathematics, a lot of my friends found it hard to understand why someone would drop out of mathematics to do philosophy. A lot of mathematicians have a conception of their field as the most fundamental field of all. Got this picture on which chemistry underlies biology, physics underlies chemistry, and mathematics underlies the whole thing. But from my perspective, there was a sense in which philosophy was somehow the highest calling of all. And my attitude was something like, well, sure, mathematics, that's the foundations of science. But philosophy, that's the foundations of everything. I mean, it's a absurdly pretentious thought that one's building the foundations of everything, or even that one's studying the foundations of everything. And when I got started, it seemed presumptuous to me somehow that someone would call themselves, that I could call myself a philosopher. But over time, I guess I realized that we all realize this is something of an ideal that we don't always live up to, we don't perhaps have to live up to. Most of us are, rather than building the foundations of everything, we're playing around with a brick or two in the foundations, fiddling with the location of the brick here and chipping away there. But I think somehow, at least, this functions as a kind of compelling ideal in the background that keeps some of us going as philosophers. But this is relevant because I have some of the same phenomenology of presumption today to be standing here giving these John Locke lectures with the absurdly grandiose title, Constructing the World. I hope the title is taken in the spirit in which it's intended, a spirit of self-conscious absurdity and grandiosity. But at the same time, homage to what I take to be one of the great works of 20th century philosophy, indeed one of the great works of philosophy by Rudolf Carnap, a book with the equally grandiose title Der logische Aufbau der Welt, often translated either the logical structure of the world or the logical construction of the world. I mean, Carnap's book really was, in a certain sense, an attempt to build or to articulate the foundations of everything. At least to set out a set of basic truths about the world from which all truths about the world could be derived, serving as an epistemological foundation, perhaps a metaphysical foundation, a semantic foundation, a theoretical foundation. I mean, these days I think the Aufbau is generally regarded as something of a heroic failure. A noble attempt, to be sure, but subject to any number of devastating objections. So my starting point is that maybe there's some life left in a project, something like the Aufbau. Now, I should diminish expectations right at the start. Okay, I'm not going to be constructing the world. I'm not going to be building or laying out the foundations of everything. I'm really not going to be doing anything quite as ambitious as what Carnap was doing. But I will be trying to argue for certain specific theses, what I call scrutability theses. Theses about the existence of certain basic truths from which all truths about the world are, in certain senses, derivable. Theses analogous to theses that Carnap argued for. And while perhaps the picture they lead to is not quite as radical as the one that Carnap got to, perhaps it still has some, I'll argue, it still has some quite significant consequences for a number of areas of philosophy that are not wholly out of the spirit of consequences that Carnap wanted to draw. So with that said, I'll move on to details. The talk today will be divided into the five parts. And although the hero of the talk is Carnap, I'm going to start with Laplace. Does somebody have a handout, by the way, just so I have one to look at? So here's a famous quote from Laplace in 1814. An intellect which at a certain moment would know all forces that set nature in motion and all positions of all items of which nature is composed. If this intellect were also vast enough to submit these data to analysis, it would embrace in a single formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the tiniest atom. For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes. So I think if you look at this marvelous passage from Laplace, you can find a philosophical thesis in there. So I'll proceed to try to destroy this beautiful prose by coming up with a couple of definitions. Let's say that the Laplacian truths are the fundamental laws and the current positions of all fundamental entities. And that a Laplacian intellect is an intellect vast enough to submit these data to analysis, I guess to some kind of ideally rational analysis. Then I think we can take the heart of that quote from Laplace as something like the following. It's a bit shorter. For a Laplacian intellect who knew all the Laplacian truths, nothing would be uncertain. So I guess that's roughly to say that for any proposition that the Laplacian intellect could entertain, it would be in a position to know whether that proposition is true. Indeed, for any question it could ask itself, be in a position to know the answer. Just say the Laplacian demon wants to know who's going to win the election tomorrow. Then entertains the proposition, maybe David Cameron's going to win. Maybe David Cameron's going to be the next prime minister. It'll get out its machinery and calculate away and come up with the answer. It'll also entertain the proposition that Gordon Brown will be re-elected. Nick Clegg will be the next prime minister. The answers to all of these things will be clear. So for my purposes, it's best just to regiment this slightly into a slightly different but closely related thesis, which I'll call Laplacian scrutability. It takes the form of what I call a scrutability thesis. For all true propositions P, a Laplacian intellect who knew all the Laplacian truths would be in a position to know P. So if indeed it is true that David Cameron's going to be the next prime minister, then a Laplacian intellect who knew all the Laplacian truths would be in a position to know that David Cameron will be the next prime minister, and so on for all the other true propositions. Now, Laplace is, by the way, is the amplification okay? It's right, good. Laplace's demon has come in for something of a battering since its early days, being put forward by Laplace. I mean, there are a number of famous problems, perhaps the most famous of which are problems tied to indeterminism. If indeed, as many people think, physical theory is indeterministic, then it looks like the physical truths, probably the fundamental truths, at a given time, are not enough to know all truths about the future because of indeterministic evolution of physical systems. Other people have argued that even physical truths across time are not enough to know certain truths about the world, namely mental truths. For example, what it's like for someone to see red, certain truths about consciousness. Some people have raised worries about self-locating truths, suggesting that all the objective truths about the physical and indeed mental world may not be enough to know such truths as it's now 25 past 5 on Wednesday, or I'm David Chalmers. There's a worry about negative truths. Maybe all the positive truths about the world are not enough to know such negative truths, if indeed they are truths, as there's no ectoplasm or there are no ghosts. And people might worry about various problematic classes of truths, moral truths, mathematical truths, metaphysical truths, and so on. Still, at this point, if you're looking for a spirit broadly for a thesis, broadly in the spirit of Laplace's, there's a natural thing to do. We just expand the base. Laplace helped himself to a very austere faith, roughly physical truths at a time, and laws of physics. But we can expand the base while still having a thesis that at least retains something of the spirit. For example, to deal with the worries about indeterminism, we might say, well, why not build into our base physical truths, you know, fundamental truths in physics across time, across space and time? Okay, if we do that, that'll make the demon's predictive work somewhat less impressive. It'll have, you know, truths built in about, you know, the microphysics of ballot boxes tomorrow and newspapers on Friday, and on you go in figuring out who wins the election. Still, it's an interesting thesis. Handle the problems about the mental. You might try to give the demon some mental truths, perhaps about consciousness. To handle problems of self-location, you might give the demon an indexical truth or two. I am such and such a Laplace's demon, located at such and such a spot. Negative truths might be handled with a that's all truth, saying roughly that this is the extent of the world, and on you go. So there's still the thought, the possibility that some relatively austere basis might serve as a basis for knowledge of all truths. So we could encapsulate that into a thesis I'll call empirical scrutability, for reasons which will become clear a bit later, and especially next time. This says that there is some compact class of truths such that for all true propositions P, if a Laplacian intellect knew all the truths in that class, it would be in a position to know P. So that's just like the Laplacian scrutability thesis, except that reference to the very specific class of Laplacian truths has been replaced by a generic reference to what I'm calling a compact class of truths. And here the thought is that a compact class of truths is roughly a relatively small class of truths. More specifically, involving some small, highly limited set of concepts, also involving no trivializing mechanisms. I'll say more about that a bit later, but the thought is we want to avoid mechanisms that have the effect of doing things like coding all truths about the universe into a single truth or a single small class of truths. So that's a relative of Laplace's thesis called empirical scrutability, somewhat more general. Now, there's another class, though, of problems for Laplace's demon and for both of these scrutability theses. And these are broadly tied to the fact that the demon is traditionally held to be inhabiting the same universe that it's attempting to know. A number of paradoxes, or at least puzzles, seem to arise. One paradox is what we might call a paradox of complexity. Looks like to know all about the world, the demon's mind is going to have to be as complex as the universe containing it, while at the same time being only one small part of that universe. As complex, but less complex. There's a potential worry there. There are paradoxes of prediction. The demon might know its own, will presumably be in a position to know its own future action, and to act otherwise. Actually, this kind of paradox of prediction has been formalized in a recent paper in a physics journal a couple of years ago, in which it was argued on quite formal grounds that there could not in principle be two Laplacian demons in a single world due to their mutual knowledge of each other. This isn't actually conditional on laws of physics. It's in any possible world. There can't be two Laplacian demons for such reasons, and you can, of course, raise problems for the existence of even one. Perhaps most familiarly, there are paradoxes of knowability. The Laplacian thesis seems to make a claim to the effect that all propositions under certain circumstances are knowable. But we have reasons to believe that's just false. Famously, the paradox due to Church and Fitch: if there's a single unknown truth, Q, maybe the Laplacian demon never, as a matter of fact, comes to know, then that yields a true statement, a true proposition that's unknowable, the truth that Q, and no one knows Q. If the demon was to know it, the proposition would then be false, so it can't be known. Okay, but I think there's a natural fix for this set of problems too, and that's to put the theses in a somewhat different form. In particular, to put the demon's knowledge into a conditional form rather than an unconditional form. The key thing is, if we do it this way, then the demon needn't inhabit the universe, the very universe that it's scrutinizing. It could be outside that universe, contemplating it conditionally. So we could put a thesis like that this way, what I'll call conditional scrutability. There's a compact class of truths such that for any true proposition P, a Laplacian intellect would be in a position to know that if the truths in that class obtain, then P. So here's the thought. Take the truths about our world, which, let's say, doesn't contain a Laplacian daemon, sadly. Then take the relevant complex class of truths about the world and any other truth about our world. Well, if there were a Laplacian daemon, it could know that if those truths obtain, then P. Now, sure, the world in which there was a Laplacian daemon might be a world in which some of those truths were false, but it doesn't matter. It's conditional knowledge here. Once you've gotten that far, there's a natural further step, which is a move to what I call a priori scrutability. Here the thought is that in conditional scrutability, those basic class, the compact class of truths, you know, the physical truths for the original Laplacian daemon, that was all the knowledge that the daemon needed to know the truth of the relevant propositions P, or to conditionally know it. Conditional scrutability is compatible with it having some other empirical background knowledge, which is doing some work in the justification. I think it's part of the spirit of the thesis, you might think, to exclude that. One way to do so is to say that conditional knowledge is, in fact, a priori. We can put this by saying there's a compact class of truths such that for any true proposition P, it's knowable a priori by a Laplacian intellect, that if the truths in that class obtain, then P. So that's like conditional scrutability with the a priori claim built in. So these are initial versions of some theses, which I'm really going to be spending quite a bit of time on in the next few lectures. I mean, my attitudes towards them are somewhat different. I mean, a priori scrutability will be, versions of a priori scrutability will really be at the heart of what I'm saying and will be what I concentrate on the most. I'm also, though, inclined to defend a version of conditional scrutability, sufficiently suitably clarified. Empirical scrutability, I think, probably has to be false for reasons alluded to. Still, next time I'll at least be interested in seeing just how close we can get to having a version of it be true. Of course, there's a lot to be said in clarifying this thesis, and that will happen today, tomorrow, today, next week, and in future weeks. In what follows for the rest of today, I'm not going to make a whole lot of positive argument for these theses. What I intend to do, I've already motivated them to some extent from the direction of Laplace. I'm going to try to motivate them from one or two different directions, especially the direction of the Aufbau, and to defend them from objections. There'll be more argument to follow in the next couple of weeks. I'll try it in the next 2 weeks. I'll try to build a sustained argument for a couple of these theses. I should say that my plan for these lectures is, very roughly speaking, the first two lectures are meant to be fairly accessible and non-technical, at least no more technical than what you've seen already. I'll cut a few corners here and there. For the next two lectures, the plan is for them to be somewhat more detailed and technical, not super technical, but I'm going to try and focus in more closely on a few key issues and theses. In the last two lectures, I'm going to step back and look at big picture and implications. And in those lectures, especially in the last one, maybe things will eventually go a little bit wild. So that'll be the payoff. I should also mention I'm putting the text. I mean, I do have a book manuscript corresponding to these lectures. I figured I shouldn't put it online in advance. You don't want the lectures to be an anticlimax. But I'll be I'll be putting the lectures online at roughly, the chapters online at roughly the time that I give the corresponding lectures. So if you go to the URL at the bottom, you'll be able to find some text corresponding to what I'm saying today, and a bit more. And maybe that's something, if anyone really has quick turnaround time in reading, I'd be happy to discuss some of that tomorrow in the discussion. Okay, so next I'm going to look at some motivation from the direction of primitive concepts. So I take it it's a familiar idea in philosophy that all concepts are somehow decomposable into a set of primitive concepts. That all expressions are definable in terms of some set of primitive expressions. Aristotle said that man is equivalent to rational animal. People have taken it that knowledge is equivalent to justified true belief. Maybe you can define all those things on in turn, and on you go. So here is our patron, John Locke. For all our complex ideas are ultimately resolvable into simple ideas, of which they are compounded and originally made up. So perhaps their immediate ingredients, as I may so say, are also complex ideas. So complex ideas resolvable into simple ideas. Familiar idea in philosophy. It's also an idea which has been pursued here and there in cognitive science. Some of you will know Roger Schenck's work on action concepts in artificial intelligence. But I think actually the most sustained attempt to pursue a project of this sort is by one of my colleagues at ANU in linguistics, working in the field of lexical semantics. This is Anna Wirzbicker's Natural Semantic Metalanguage. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Wirzbicker's work. My experience is it's not as well known among philosophers as perhaps it should be. It's a really fascinating project from the point of view of a philosopher. Wirzbicker is trying to isolate linguistic primes, she calls them, primitive expressions. They've got subject to certain constraints. Every expression in language has to be definable in terms of them. Furthermore, you have to find terms corresponding to these primes in every known language. She started with 14 such primitive expressions in her book on semantic primitives back in 1972. Since then, it's grown over the years to the point where now she has about 62. In fact, I got an email from her the other day where she told me it's now 63. Here's the list. It's quite, it's a little bit odd from a philosopher's perspective. Substantives are I, you, someone, people, something, body. Already a little bit puzzling. You might have, can't you get someone from something and people? determiners, this, the same. Quantifiers, one, two, some, all, many, much. Evaluators, good, bad. Augmenters, very, more. Mental predicates, reassuringly for the non-reductionists about the mental among us. Think. No, that ought to make Tim Williamson happy. Want. Feel. Well, that should make me happy. See. Hear. And on you go. Say words true. Anyway, you get the idea. Now, obviously the rules here, right? It's a little bit hard to know exactly what the rules of the game are here for a weird speaker. They're clearly a little bit different from the philosopher's rules of the game, and I've spent a bit of time talking about that with her, but I'm still not entirely clear. Still, it's clear that from a philosopher's perspective, this is a fascinating project. And much of her work is actually devoted to setting out and articulating analyses, explicit definitions of all the relevant of terms. I mean, not of every single term in every single language, but of a vast number of terms, mostly in the English language. Throughout all kinds of domains. There's a whole book on emotions, for example. I mean, here's one of my favorites, Wirzbicker's analysis of lying. X lied to Y. Okay, well, that's X said something to person Y. X knew it wasn't true. X said it because X wanted Y to think it was true. People think it's bad if someone does this. These definitions are really like haiku. I mean, you should see the definition of an umbrella. It's quite remarkable. Okay, philosophers can have a field day with this sort of thing. I mean, finding counterexamples to this definition is left as an exercise to the reader. Philosophers, it's not too difficult. Again, maybe this interacts with the question of criteria of adequacy. Still, fascinating project. The most famous and central instance of this kind of project in philosophy, I mean, you can find bits of it in Russell, but surely the most famous instance of this program in philosophy is the Aufbau. In the Aufbau, Carnap proposes a single non-logical primitive. You know, where Wirzbicker has 62, lexical semantics, you do have 62. Well, we philosophers, we can do it with just one. Well, strictly speaking, I guess logic plus one. So, and it's one single relational notion, recollected phenomenal similarity. Roughly similarity between total experiences of a subject. It's a phenomenal primitive in the sense that it's about conscious experience. And it's roughly the idea is that two experiences stand in the similarity relation if those total experiences are similar in some respect. Maybe intuitively a color location respect. They both involve red at that location, or on you go. Of course, that's not explicitly articulated in the base. Furthermore, he actually ultimately proposes, towards the end of the Aufbau, that we can dispense even with this primitive, yielding only logical primitives, hence the logical structure of the world. All other expressions can be defined in terms of these primitives. So, roughly the idea is, let's say we start with phenomenal similarity, which is the way Carnap proceeds for most of the book. Well, then Carnap tries to define certain specific qualia in terms of phenomenal similarity. So, the quality of a certain kind of red experience, or red at a certain location, is characterized in terms of certain kinds of similarity circles of the phenomenal similarity relation with certain kinds of nice properties that Carnap thinks might somehow correspond to the existence of things which are intuitively qualia. He defines space-time and distribution of certain properties like color properties in space-time in terms of qualia. He defines behavioral properties of humans and others in terms of distribution of these properties in space-time. He defines other minds in terms of behavior, and he goes on to analyze culture. He defines culture in terms of behavior and other minds. Now, admittedly, the pace picks up a bit as the book goes along. He spends a whole lot of time on the first step, a reasonable amount of time on the second step. By the time we get down to culture, that's about 4 pages, and then there's 2 pages for ethics. Still, it's programmatic, but you can see the project there. This suggests some theses. Both the Carnap project and the Weizsäcker project and other projects suggest some theses. One of these we might call the definability thesis. So, by the way, the handout just consists of a list of theses. It's not exactly an outline of the talk, but it's just there to refer back to, especially for discussion. The definability thesis: there's a compact class of primitive expressions such that all expressions are definable in terms of expressions in that class. So for Weizsäcker, the class is 62. For Carnap, the class is logic, or logic plus 1. Now, what's a definition? Well, here's an example of a definition, or definition sentence. For all X, X is a bachelor, if and only if X is an unmarried man. So there's a couple of constraints on definitions, or a certain sort of sentence. I'll take it. They have to have an appropriate logical form perhaps determined by the kind of expression we're dealing with, singular term, general term, predicate. This is the way it might work for a general term. And furthermore, they have to meet certain conditions of adequacy. It's pretty helpful if they at least be true. And traditionally, they're subject to further conditions of adequacy. They be analytic, or perhaps that they be a priori. They be necessarily true, true in all possible worlds. That the terms on the right-hand side be in a certain sense conceptually prior to the term defined on the left. And there be some kind of length constraints. Hopefully the definition at least be finite. And on you go. Different accounts will give different conditions of adequacy. Actually, one of the most puzzling features of the Aufbau on reading through it is that Carnap's criteria for adequacy are extraordinarily weak. Basically, all he requires is that the definitions be true. It's a criterion of extensional adequacy. He doesn't impose any requirement like analyticity, a priority, necessity. It makes it very hard to see how this project can really do the kind of epistemological or semantic work that he wants it to do. And indeed, in the preface to the second edition of the Aufbau, he goes on to call this his greatest mistake in the Aufbau. He said he should have subjected it to more strongly intentional criteria of adequacy. But I think much of the Aufbau can be read with something like those stronger criteria in mind. Now, with the definability thesis in hand, there's what we might call a definitional scrutability thesis that's suggested from this, to put it in the form of the kind of scrutability theses we've had so far, now directed, though, at linguistic items like sentences rather than propositions. Here's one stab at it. There's a compact class of truths, namely true sentences, such that for any truth S, S is logically entailed by truths in that class along with adequate definition sentences. Now, that doesn't follow from the definability thesis. I mean, a lot depends on the character of a language and the criteria of adequacy of definitions. If definitions are only required to be extensionally adequate, then you better have an extensional language. If definitions are required to be intentionally adequate to a certain degree, the language to be intentional to that degree, and on you go. But there's a rough pairing there. Of course, there's all kinds of issues that arise once one starts doing things in terms of sentences, which I'll largely be doing for the rest of the talk. One big issue is the issue of context dependence. Do we have to presumably, given the phenomenon of context dependence, these definitions and these scrutability relations will have to somehow be relativized to subjects or contexts or utterances or tokens. But I'll set those issues aside for now and return to them a bit in the next talks. Now, if definitions are required to be a priori among their conditions of adequacy, then it looks like you get a version of the a priori scrutability thesis out of the definitional scrutability thesis. I mean, to follow it flat-footedly, you just get the following thesis. There's a compact class C of truths, such that all truths are logically entailed by the truth in C, along with a priori truths, because after all, definitions are required to be a priori. Likewise, if definitions are required to be analytic or necessary, we'll get corresponding analytic or necessary scrutability theses. So that's a rough sentential analog of the propositional a priori scrutability thesis that I mentioned before. Again, I'll be refining this quite a lot in what follows. There's any number of issues which come up in thinking about refining this. I mean, I mentioned context dependence already. Maybe there are going to be issues about infinitary entailment in certain cases. There are certainly going to be issues about vagueness and determinacy. But let's just set those issues aside for now and go with something like this. Okay, so what's the scrutability thesis you get from Carnap? Then, well, I guess it's a definitional scrutability thesis. Roughly. I mean, the one he ends up with at the end is that all truths are definitionally scrutable from truths in logical vocabulary. Just, you know, quantifiers and existential notions. Sorry, quantifiers, connectives, the standard stuff. I think it's mostly first order. Plus, and for most of the Aufbau, it's a slightly weaker thesis. All truths are definitionally scrutable from truths in logical vocabulary plus a single relational expression for phenomenal similarity. And this gives you the idea that, you know, basically for Carnap, there ends up being a single world sentence that entails everything. If we do it in the relational framework where he has the phenomenal similarity relation, let's call it R, then we might write the world sentence as, you know, something like the following. There exists X, and there exists Y, and there exists Z, and on you go, such that RXY and RXZ, it's not the case that RYZ, and on you go, with, you know, a whole lot more complex quantification and a whole lot more complex relational structure. But the whole world is basically being characterized in terms of the existence, the structure of the world, of objects in the world, with respect to this relation R. I mean, ultimately, when he gets rid of R, then it's simpler still. I mean, R gets definable away, but as a certain, via a certain definite description that's supposed to pick it out. And then you've just got a whole lot of existential claims and in maybe some universal claims and in complex logical form. And that world sentence, via the definitions of higher level expressions in terms of lower level expressions, is supposed to entail everything. So that's the project. And I think it really does deserve the... I mean, if it were to succeed, it really would deserve the title, at least in a certain sense, of being a construction of the world. Okay, as I already said, there are any number of famous problems for the Aufbau. I'll isolate six here, perhaps six of the most famous. The most famous of all, I think, is Nelson Goodman's criticism of Carnap's construction of qualia from phenomenal similarity relations. Goodwin argues that there can be similarity circles that don't correspond to what you'd arguably think of as qualia, so you get false positives there. That's in the structure of appearance. Well, perhaps equally famous are Quine's criticisms in section 5 of Two Dogmas of Empiricism, where Quine argues that Carnap's definition of space-time in terms of qualia violates Carnap's own rules on adequacy of definitions by not falling into the right form. Basically, he ends up assuming certain spatiotemporal elements rather than constructing it explicitly in terms of phenomenal elements as promised. The mathematician Max Neumann, in a well-known 1928 paper, raised a problem for Carnap's logical construction. In fact, Neumann directed it at a very similar set of claims by Russell in The Analysis of Matter. He didn't seem to have read Carnap at the time, and Carnap notes the problem himself late in the Aufbau. It's basically the problem that the pure logical construction, any purely logical characterization of the world in logical vocabulary, is almost vacuous. Basically, it can be satisfied by any set of the right cardinality. If it's satisfied by one set of a certain cardinality, it's satisfied by any set of that cardinality, at least if we're liberal about what counts as a relation, a property, and so on. We can always find some set of... The logical sentence is going to say things like there exist relations and there exist properties and there exist objects that stand in a certain structure with respect to each other. If we're liberal about relations and properties, we can always find ones that work. Okay, so those first three are all problems about Carnap's base, if you like, his scrutability base. The other ones are problems tied to his relations. Famously, Quine in Two Dogmas argued there's no analytic synthetic distinction. Been read as saying no a priori a posteriori distinction. If that's right, then if the project is read as attempting to provide analytic definitions, there's a problem. Other problems are tied to the very existence of definitions or descriptions corresponding to expressions. So famously in Naming and Necessity, Kripke has argued that names just are not equivalent in any sense, necessarily, a priori, analytically, to descriptions. If so, we're going to have a hard time producing names, sentences about names by this method. And many have argued that most expressions of a natural language are, in fact, undefinable. Definitions just aren't available. So then we've got six main problems for the Aufbau, on which I'll concentrate. Still, I think there's a very natural reaction for people trying to maintain an Aufbau-like project while acknowledging some of these problems. The first three problems, I think, are dealt with relatively straightforwardly. The first three problems are problems only for the specific base expressions that Carnap chooses, the phenomenal base, or indeed the logical base, in the case of Neumann's problem. And now, there's no particular commitment to that base, I think, on Carnap's part. He says himself in the Aufbau, it's an arbitrary choice. He went with the phenomenal base. He could equally have gone with, say, a physical base. So in the spirit of our amendment to Laplace's thesis, you might say, okay, well, we'll expand the base beyond the phenomenal base. Perhaps we'll bring in some spatiotemporal expressions. Perhaps we'll bring in some physical expressions. Perhaps some causal expressions. You could still have a thesis very much in the spirit of Carnap's. Now, it's true you'd lose some properties that are often associated with Carnap's project. Once you start bringing in, say, physics or space-time in the base, then you're certainly going to water down you're going to sever the strong connection to theses like phenomenalism, verificationism, strong epistemological foundationalism, which are often read into the Aufbau and certainly associated with the common caricatures of the logical empiricists. Now, I think the trend among scholars of the Aufbau in recent years has been to point out that these theses are far less central to the project of the Aufbau than is often assumed in the caricature. So we don't take this to be too much of a loss. But certainly, those theses, verificationism, phenomenalism, are not going to be an essential part of what I'm arguing. Maybe you'll be able to descend some distant cousins of them in what I say. If so, that'll be interesting. But certainly not the flat-footed kind, subject to fairly straightforward objections. The other three problems were all tied to the relation, the specific relation between the base sentences and the rest of the sentences. I take it that the last two or three problems are problems only for Carnap's definitional entailment relation, the one that specifically relies on definitions. So you might think, why not weaken the relation? And what I'm going to suggest is rely on a priori entailment relation in what follows. I should mention, by the way, a related project by Hannes Leitgeb, where he's tried to find new life for Carnap's Aufbau through quite a different method. Hannes really keeps Carnap's phenomenal base, and he even keeps the reliance on definitions. What he does is changes the criteria of adequacy quite dramatically to argue for a kind of equivalent that he calls sameness of empirical content, that has the property that you can have empirical equivalence, say, between two sentences when one is true and the other one is false. So it doesn't even preserve extensional adequacy. For me, that's just a bit too radical. At least it doesn't serve my purposes, but I point to that as another interesting way to go. So, a revised Aufbau thesis, then, where Carnap said all truths are definitionally entailed by, say, logical or logical and phenomenal truths, it's still viable to say, well, all truths are a priori entailed by some compact class of truths. And that's a version of our thesis of a priori scrutability, what I'll be concentrating on, and which I'll be arguing can do a fair amount of the work that an Aufbau thesis, you might want an Aufbau thesis to do. I mean, I've already been over the... I've already said something about the problems for the base in the case of Laplace, and it's fairly obvious how you might deal with those. In what follows, I'll say a little bit about two of the problems for the relation, the definition problem, and I'll briefly touch on Kripke's arguments against descriptivism. But the central thing here is the problem for definitions, what we'll call the counterexample problem. For many terms in natural language, all purported definitions appear to have counterexamples, very often actual counterexamples. But if not actual counterexamples, then at least conceivable counterexamples or possible counterexamples. So it starts to look like these definitions aren't true, or at least aren't a priori, or aren't necessary. And this, I think, has been responsible perhaps for the single greatest part of the opposition to definitions in both philosophy, cognitive psychology, and related areas. So, I mean, the most familiar case here is the case of knowledge, which I'll take with and run with just briefly. Knowledge does raise some special issues. I mean, it's a normative concept. Some people think it's primitive, and on you go. I'm going to set aside really the special features here and take it as paradigmatic, as typical. If you don't like the case, we could say much of what follows with another case, like lying or chair. But, take the traditional definition of knowledge. It's justified true belief. Then, okay, well, Gettier came along and found a counterexample, where it looked like someone had a justified true belief, but they didn't have knowledge. So, okay, someone suggests a refined definition. Maybe knowledge is justified true belief, not inferred from a falsehood. Then someone else finds a counterexample involving fake Barnes. We have that, you still don't have knowledge. And on the process goes. Eventually you find a 12 or 14 clause definition of knowledge due to Chisholm. Someone else finds a counterexample, and there's just no end in sight. All this is outlined in that wonderful book, Shope's Analysis of Knowledge, which some people see as kind of a horror movie for epistemology, one monster after another. Furthermore, this seems typical. It's not like knowledge is an outlier here. This phenomenon seems typical. So, a lot of people take the moral to be that there's just not much reason to believe that no, or indeed arbitrary, expressions are definable in more primitive vocabulary with those standard conditions of adequacy. Still, and I will take the conditions of adequacy I mentioned at least to be the standard ones. We can talk later about relaxing them. But this is compatible, I think, with the claim that no truths are at least a priori entailed by truths in a more primitive vocabulary. That is, giving up definitional scrutability retains the possibility of a priori scrutability. So to take a Gettier case, for example, and this is just here, I'm just developing a point which Frank Jackson and I made in a paper a few years ago. Let's say the sentence G is, S believes with justification that Jones owns a Ford. So let's say S believes with justification that Jones owns a Ford. S has no evidence concerning whether Brown is in Barcelona. S forms a belief that Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona based solely on a valid inference from his belief that Jones owns a Ford. Now, as it happens, Jones does not own a Ford, but Brown is, as a matter of fact, in Barcelona. Now, let K be the claim that S doesn't know that Jones owns a Ford or Brown is in Barcelona. Now, I think Gettier makes the case that in a situation in which G is the case, K is the case. S doesn't, in fact, know that P or Q is the case, even though S has a justified true belief to that effect. And I think you can make a pretty plausible case that if G, then K is a priori, at least insofar as one's sympathetic to the a priori at all. It looks like this isn't turning on any particular background empirical information. It's largely the kind of thing that people engage in through non-empirical reasoning, using concepts that they possess. So this is at least a prima facie case that this is a priori. So if that's right, then it looks like a priori scrutability doesn't actually require definitions. I mean, there's a model where for there to be an a priori connection, there must always be a mediating definition. It must rely on a mediating definition. The model I prefer, I think suggested by this case, is that mediating definitions are certainly not required. Instead, you get a different kind of picture of, say, conceptual analysis, what we might call case-wise conceptual analysis. A priori conditionals regarding specific scenarios. You know, in that scenario, if that scenario is actual, S knows that P. If that scenario is actual, S doesn't know that P, and so on. You know, maybe sometimes these scenarios will be describable quite briefly. In the extreme case, these scenarios may have to be described at great length to the point of describing whole possible worlds. But that's okay, especially for allowing idealization. This will be modeled here, not by a definition, but instead by something like an intention, a function, a mapping from scenarios to truth values. Again, in this scenario, it's a bottle. In this scenario, this thing's not a bottle. And on you go. In this scenario, John's lying. In this scenario, John's not lying. On you go. Not a definition. Counterexample definitions, I think. Counterexample arguments like of the Gettier style threaten the claim that expressions have definitions, at least definitions subject to the kinds of conditions of adequacy that we've mentioned. But they don't seem to threaten the claim that expressions are associated with intentions or indeed with a priori scrutability relations. In fact, I think there's reasons to believe that it's hard in principle for a counterexample argument to threaten the claim there's an intention or a scrutability relation from a description of a scenario to a verdict about the truth of a sentence. After all, counterexample arguments always proceed by exhibiting a scenario, like a Gettier case or some complicated case of lying, and forming some judgment about the truth value of S knows that P, or someone is lying. With respect to that scenario, that might be a counterexample to a given definition. It can always be modeled by, captured by an appropriate intention that just captures our judgments about the truth of the sentence in the scenario. I mean, there's a lot to be said here about weakening the conditions of adequacy on definitions to allow, for example, approximate definitions or infinitary definitions at this point. But maybe the definitional model could be saved with infinitary definitions. But in a way, I think the deeper point here is that definitions really just aren't, even if there are such definitions on this model, definitions just aren't to the point. They're not the key thing in understanding concepts. I mean, I think of this as going along with a picture which, you know, with due respect to Quine, we might call the scrutability of reference, the picture on which possessing a concept goes along with a conditional ability to determine reference given empirical information and given sufficient reasoning. So it's an ability to, the idea is that once you have a concept, you've got a certain ability to home in on reference, a theme that's been very, very familiar with in much 20th century philosophy. And here the thought is, here's a thesis we might call the scrutability of reference. Given enough information about the world and enough reasoning, we're in a position to know the extensions of our terms. And a sentential version of that might be, given all that, we're in a position to know the truth values of our sentences. I find that an attractive thesis. There's a lot to be said about bringing out just the relation of this thesis to Quine's inscrutability of reference thesis. I mean, one thing that's worth observing is even if you are moved by Quine's inscrutability thesis for reference, most people are inclined to think that the key cases of reference permutation and inscrutability preserve, don't permute truth. So even if you think that reference is inscrutable, there's still a scrutability of truth thesis in the background for truth values, which is where I've been concentrating. I'm inclined to defend the reference thesis too. Okay, this is a picture, by the way, I've developed in a bit of earlier work. I should say that in these lectures, I'm trying not to presuppose anything that I've done in earlier work. I'm presuming that most people here aren't going to have read the relevant thing. So to those few of you, to those of you who have, looked at who do know the relevant bits of my work, I apologize for occasional repetition. I figure that this is the better strategy to take. I'll certainly try to go well beyond the things I've said in those places, which are usually deep in the middle of long papers, which I'm not sure that anyone's ever gotten to the end of anyway. So might as well exploit the captive audience while I have it. I'm told the audience that the numbers are going to drop off dramatically by next week anyway. Just to mention Kripke's anti-descriptive arguments. Kripke has two main sets of arguments, the modal and epistemological arguments. Maybe there are others. The modal arguments say that, when n's a name and d's a description, that n equals to d isn't necessary. Well, that concerns necessity, not a priority, so I think it's pretty obviously no objection to a priori scrutability. Kripke himself notes the claim that a term like a Gödel as a rigid designator is at least compatible with the claim that its reference is fixed descriptively and some descriptive claim is a priori. The more worrying claim might be the epistemic argument. The argument that Gödel is the prover of incompleteness is not even a priori, because we can imagine cases, we can imagine scenarios where it comes out false. We say, if we discovered something, we'd say, well, that person proved the incompleteness of arithmetic and they weren't Gödel. But that's just an argument from counterexample. It's an argument analogous to the Gettier case for our purposes. And for the same reasons that the Gettier case is not an objection to a priori scrutability as it stands, this isn't an objection either. So I think, again, Kripke's data are straightforwardly compatible with the thesis. So, okay, if that's right, that's interesting, because it looks like we've got a thesis here in the Carnapian spirit, which at least can handle five of the six major criticisms of the Aufbau. I haven't said anything about Quine's criticisms in Two Dogmas. I'm going to save a whole lecture for that. It'll be the fourth time around. But still, interesting. So far, these objections are defeated, which is not to say there are no objections. I'm sure there are going to be quite a few of them. But if there are serious objections to a thesis, at least they'll be interestingly different ones. So that's the hope. Okay, I just want to say something briefly before closing about the scrutability base and about applications. A scrutability base is a class of truths from which all truths are scrutable in various senses of scrutable. A minimal scrutability base is a minimal class of truths from which all truths are scrutable. All kinds of interesting questions. What is the character of a minimal scrutability base? The scrutability thesis of various kinds says, well, the first, at least one of the kinds I'm interested in, the core kind I'm interested in, is a thesis that there's a compact scrutability base. Now, what is it for a class of truths to be compact? Well, this is a tricky question, but to a first approximation, the thought is that ideally it involves a small finite class of expressions, or perhaps we can allow a small finite class of families of expressions. Maybe you want, say, phenomenal expressions in there, and there's a whole bunch of phenomenal expressions, but still just one family. Now, of course, that's a vague claim. I'm not going to come up with a magic number. The ultimate question is, how many expressions are there? Do they need to be in a scrutability base? And the answer is 42. I'd be happy if there were turned out to be less than 42. Less than 10 would be ideal. Also, no trivializing mechanisms. Here, roughly, the thought is that, again, if you code all the truths into one single truth, there are various things you can do that would trivialize this. Take the class of propositional truths. Propositional expressions. Expressions that refer to propositions, like, the cat sat on the mat, in italics. And take the expression true, or is true. then just take, oh, I've got a compact scrutability base. It consists just of certain claims about propositions to the effect that they're true. Pretty plausibly from there, you can derive all kinds of arbitrary sentences. So that would be a trivializing mechanism. And there, you know, it's easy to come up with other trivializing mechanisms. It would be nice to say a bit more about this and make that a bit more adequate. In practice, I think it won't matter too much. We can just basically take this dialectically. I'll offer some specific scrutability bases. I think they'll fairly clearly be small enough to be interesting and not trivializing. In a couple of cases, there'll be the threat of trivialization, and then we can just examine that threat on its own terms. I mean, what are some candidates for the scrutability base? I mean, I'll really be concentrating on this question towards the end of the lectures. But you might think, some we've mentioned already, phenomenal truths, perhaps microphysical truths, perhaps spatiotemporal truths, perhaps gnomic truths about laws or causation, indexical truths about I am such and such, now is such and such, perhaps a that's all truth, saying, you know, this is all there is in the world. Some people would argue for further categories here, maybe normative truths involving oughts or reasons or values, intentional truths, ontological truths, secondary quality truths, quidistic truths about the nature of the intrinsic qualities of underlying microphysics. I mean, I think that my own view is that you only need perhaps only a small set of these. That microphysical truths you can get rid of if you want to by a Ramsey sentence method. My own view is you don't even need spatiotemporal truths. I do think you need gnomic truths, indexicals, that's all we'll get to. But these are matters of philosophical substance. And of the long list there, maybe there's a role for quidistic truths. Anyway, people can argue about what goes in there, and we'll get to this later on. But the thought is, if you've got a list of even 5 or 6 or 7 of these families from which everything is scrutable, that's certainly small enough to be interesting and to do an awful lot of work. I'll note that, of course, you also are going to want, at the very least, a good helping of logical and mathematical expressions to state the claims in your scrutability base. Whether you actually need logical or mathematical truths will depend on whether you take those things to be, say, a priori. You may not need them there if they're a priori. You'll at least need those expressions plausibly to state things like phenomenal microphysical truths. Now, of course, there'll be many scrutability bases, even many minimal scrutability bases. Question: is there a privileged scrutability base? You know, is there God's scrutability base? What does God's scrutability base look like? One thought here. I think I'm really going to concentrate on some privileged principled bases later on. But one thought here is we might invoke a grounding relation more fine-grained than a priori entailment at this point. Now, maybe a primitive scrutability thesis. All truths are scrutable from truths involving only primitive concepts, where primitive concepts are those that are primitive with respect to a conceptual grounding relation. Yeah. Or a fundamental scrutability thesis. All truths are scrutable from metaphysically fundamental truths, where metaphysically fundamental truths are the metaphysical ground for all truths. That's a thesis I've discussed a bit in earlier work. I should say these metaphysical questions won't be quite so front and central in what follows. I'll be concentrating more on epistemological and semantic questions, but we'll certainly these questions will come up. Finally, I just want to say something very briefly about applications. I mean, why is this scrutability thesis of more than technical interest? Well, I think it has many applications in many areas of philosophy. I mean, in epistemology, and perhaps most obviously, the scrutability thesis is a kind of watered-down version of the famous knowability thesis, that all truths are knowable. It certainly doesn't entail that thesis, and I think it isn't subject to the obvious problems of that thesis. You might even make a case that something like it is the plausible core of a knowability thesis. That's, I think, something worth exploring. I think some scrutability theses have anti-skeptical applications. I mean, most obviously, Carnap thought that phenomenal scrutability theses had anti-skeptical applications, but something like that might also apply to extensions thereof, like phenomenal gnomic scrutability theses. In metaphysics, principled theses such as fundamental scrutability can be used to help adjudicate what's fundamental and indeed what's true. So, if mental sentences are not scrutable from physical truths, then either physical truths don't exhaust the fundamental truths, or mental sentences are not true. if you take it for granted that mental sentences are true, mental truths are not scrutable from physical truths, then physical truths don't exhaust the fundamental truth. That's a kind of argument I've made before in some other work. Likewise, if moral sentences are not scrutable from physical truths, then either physical truths don't exhaust the fundamental truths, or moral sentences are not true. In that case, you know, different people might draw different morals. At least this really constrains the options in adjudicating what's fundamental, what's true. And you could use these to argue for expansions of ontology, for anti-realism about the domain, and on you go. Worth mentioning applications to modality and meaning, which are really very central to my own interests. Here I think of the project as picking up on a combination of this early Carnap of the Aufbau with a later phase of Carnap in meaning and necessity, where he looked at possible worlds and their role in analysis of meaning. I mean, one can use a generalized version of the scrutability thesis. It's on the handout, but the details don't matter too much here. One that applies not just to the actual world, but to a broader range of worlds and sentences to construct a space of epistemically possible worlds or scenarios, perhaps as maximal consistent sets of sentences in a generalized scrutability base. I actually gave a talk about that, I think, on epistemic space here in the Jawa Society a few years ago. I think that's useful for many epistemological purposes, and one can then investigate at least the tie between that epistemic space and the space of metaphysically possible worlds. Furthermore, once you've done that, there are interesting applications to questions about meaning. You can use that generalized scrutability thesis to define intentions over the relevant space of scenarios. Functions, for example, a given expression with a certain kind of extension might have an intention which we could define as a function from scenarios to extensions. After all, if the extension of a, you know, the truth value of a sentence is scrutable from a description of a scenario in the language of a scrutability base, then it's straightforward to use that to define an intention for a sentence, a function from intentions to truth values. These turn out to have very nice properties, and roughly in the way in which Carnap argued in Meaning and Necessity that intentions have nice properties, quasi-Frege-ian properties. One such property, I think you can make a case for, a sentence A is true at all scenarios if and only if A is a priori. Here's another one. Just say we get this working for singular terms. Two singular terms, A and B, will have the same intention if and only if the identity claim A equals B is a priori. There we have, that's a little bit reminiscent of the Frege-ian thesis that A and B have the same sense if the identity is cognitively insignificant. It's not exactly the same as that, but in a corresponding way it connects semantic values to epistemological role and gives us, I think, potential grounds for a Frege-ian approach to philosophy of language. I think that can be used to, in a way, provide epistemological foundations for the sort of epistemological 2D semantics that I'm interested in. I think you can go on to apply to mental content. You can make a case that certain scrutability theses can be used to define narrow contents, environment-independent ones, and in the philosophy of science, there's the potential, I think, of a framework for certain forms of structuralism, like Carnap's structuralism, and indeed a certain kind of chain of reductive explanation. These are theses I'll come back to in the last lecture. So overall, I think that I actually see these scrutability theses, you know, technical though they may seem, as suggesting a certain kind of, I mean, John said that the conscious mind was something of a throwback. So maybe the scrutability thesis suggests something of a throwback thesis as well. In these cases, throwback to the age of Frege, Russell, and Carnap. I think, you know, many of the theses popular in that era can be, versions of them might be vindicated or suggested by the scrutability project. And correspondingly, I think it suggests at least limitations on many trends which have been popular in the last 60-odd years of philosophy. I'm not going to say it refutes all these people, because it very much depends on how their theses are cast, but at least greatly limits the consequences that people have tried to draw from them. So Kripke on names, maybe a Frege-ian response to Kripke on names, limits Putnam and Burge on externalism, I'll come back to that, limits Quine on analyticity and a priority. Perhaps it even, you know, stands in tension with some theses which are popular around here. You know, maybe probably hasn't escaped your attention that there's potential tensions with with theses popular with the Wainfleet professor over here and the Wickham professor, including but not limited to the epistemic theory of vagueness and a number of others. I think there's at the very least interesting relations to be explored. So finally then, to conclude with applications to meta-philosophy, I'm an optimist at heart. So I think, you know, one can see this as opening the door to a certain kind of meta-philosophical optimism, conditional on knowledge of base truths and ideal reasoning. Everything is knowable. You've at least got conditional, the possibility of conditional knowledge there. Now, that doesn't rule out our ignorance, but at least locates and limits our ignorance. It sort of locates it, traces our ignorance either to ignorance of relevant base truths or non-ideality of our reasoning. Now, of course, it's not obvious that all philosophically relevant base truths are knowable. And it's not obvious that our reasoning is sufficiently ideal for philosophical purposes. But I think it's not out of the question either. After all, philosophy is still young, and the human capacity for reasoning is strong. So to conclude in this optimistic spirit, I might suggest that in a scrutable world, truth just may be within reach. Thank you.